I would like very much to answer this question, what is sentimentality? Now let's take that song by Mendelssohn, which had aroused this question, Die Liebende Schreibt. It is written in a very simple and beautiful moving line. It is the singer's task to infuse it with its own strengths, to give it a kind of a special character. If you give too much emotion, then you would break the frame of this music. If you give too little, then the song would become insignificant. It's a question of temperament. There are people who like to weep, but we should not drag this enjoyment of being sad into our music. We should bring strength. We should give an emotion which stems from strength and not from tearful weakness.
Ein Blick von deinen Augen in die meine, ein Kuss von deinem Mund auf meinem Munde, wer davon hat wie ich gewisse Kunde, kann dem aus Angst noch erfreulich scheinen. Entfernt von dir, entfremdet von den meinen, führ ich stets die Gedanken in die Runde und immer treffen sie auf jene Stunde, die ich hab so vor. Die Tränen trocknet wieder, unversehens, er liebt ja, denk ich, er in diese Stille. Und solltest du nicht in die Ferne weichen,
Schreibt by Felix Mendelssohn. It was the intense lyrical passion with the lack of indulgent sentimentality that stood out so tellingly in Lottie Lehmann's interpretations of romantic German Lieder. As I said in the previous hour, although she was such a worldwide revelation, her highly expressive and sometimes theatrical sounding readings did cause some controversy in some places, and especially when she occasionally took some liberties with the composer's scores. Actually, liberties is probably not the right word to use. She always had a total musical and poetic conviction for everything she performed, and there were times when that led her to believe that there was good reason to depart from the exact letter of the score.
I think that's not what interested her about being a singer. Sometimes singers have that boldness. Sometimes, and I must say not always, but sometimes, they can achieve a higher truth by following their instincts. And providing the instincts are finely honed, they can make many friends for a song or an opera that maybe a more dutiful performance wouldn't.
Graham Johnson, and his view is echoed by the baritone Thomas Hampson, whose teacher studied with Lotte Lehmann.
What I truly treasure about Lotte Lehmann singing is exactly this immediate connection between word as a metaphor of thought and emotion as a vehicle of the music. And I just am always terribly captivated. And I'm now, as I become older, I'm also very intrigued with the song she chose to sing over and over again. I think that whatever latitudes that we've become terribly anal retentive about in the modern generation, I think we would do well to understand why, just the big why of her decision-making in interpreting songs. And then perhaps we would get over our own rather self-indulgent parameters that we think we've become so much more enlightened and strict with.
A particularly notable example of Lotte Lehmann's individual approach to the score comes at the end of Schubert's Erlkönig-Lied. There are three characters in the song: the agitated father, the frightened young boy, and the sinister Erlkönig spirit. At the very end, Lotte Lehmann sings the words, "In seinem Armen das Kind war tot," in his arms the child was dead, exactly as Schubert indicates, like a free recitative. But then, with the last two notes, which Schubert writes as a tritone for war tot, she declaims the words in a spoken gasp. But when you hear the way she introduced the song herself in this 1941 recital, in which she was accompanied by Paul Ulanowski, you understand why.
"I would like to sing the Erl King Frank. The poem is by Goethe. The listener must feel the eeriness of the stormy night through which the father rides with his child deathly sick in his arms. He must feel the longing care of the father as he tries to quiet the mounting fear of the feverish child, terribly frightened of the Erl King, who exists only in the child's imagination. He must feel the anguish of the child, who in terror hears the voice and sees the face of the sinister ghostly figure, the terrifying phantom of the Erl King, to whom he finally succumbs. He must see the Erl King in his misty shroud, the evil fatal look, and hear the malicious whispering voice, and always the storm and the racing hoofs of the horse up to the breathless climax. In his arms, the child was dead." Mein Sohn, ich sehe es genau, erscheint.
Weine die alten Weiden so braun. Ich liebe dich, dich reizt deine schöne Gestalt. Und bist du nicht willig, so brauch ich aber.
What I absolutely value about the great singer, not that she gets all her historical facts right, not even that she has a completely clockwork mechanism of a singing technique that is faultless, but that she has imagination to burn, fantasy, enthusiasm, a desire to share, a huge sense of drama, and all of this reflected somehow in the timbre of the voice, where in the real colour of the voice there is something that makes you want to cry in the colour, simply because of its humanity. And all those things, I suggest, are part of it. A sort of a throb, something that is unique, that composers like Strauss so valued, probably preferred Madame Lehmann singing the wrong notes to many other singers singing the right ones. And I'm not saying that she always sung the wrong notes, of course she didn't, but she was not a totally flawless individual. I don't think anybody would actually say that she was a paragon amongst musicians and technical singers. She was more interesting than that. She was a volcano, a force of nature, a sort of a type of... We accept it more with Italian singers. There is something of the great temperament of the Italian singer in Lotte Lehmann, across the Alps, Italian, across the Dolomites. A northern singer, yes, a singer that loved her German tradition, loved her German poetry, loved her Heine and Goethe and Schubert, loved the Winterreiser so much that she sang it, one of the few successful women singers, I think, to do so. One of the people who had a huge humanity in many respects, but, oh, there is something about her where you actually feel that there's a rivalry there. It's not the normal, slightly calculated, slightly cool, slightly contained element that you find in many German singers. This is a German singer who's got what I call Italianate energy.
Wenn mein Herz die Busen spricht, sing ich hell und munter. Höre nicht, was es mir sagt, habe keine Ohren. Ist für Toren. Lustig in die Welt hinein, gegen Wind und Wetter. Will kein Gott auf Erden sein, sind wir selber Götter. Lustig in die Welt hinein, gegen Wind und Wetter. Will kein Gott auf Erden sein,
when the snow flies in my face, I brush it away. When my heart cries out in my breast, I sing bright and cheery. I don't hear what it tells me. I have no ears. I don't sense its complaining. Complaining is for fools. Stride into the world gaily, against all wind and weather. If there is no God on earth, we ourselves are gods. Mut, courage, from Schubert's Winterreise. Graham Johnson mentioned before that he felt Lotte Lehmann was one of the few women singers who've successfully performed Winterreise, which expresses the desperation and descent into near madness of a young man who's been rejected by his beloved. Charles Osborne feels the same way about Lotte Lehmann's performance of the work.
That didn't seem to worry her whether the sex was right or not. She just saw it as human emotion, and whether it was meant to be a woman singing to or about a man, or vice versa. And it wasn't that she tried to assume a male role. She just went to the heart of the actual human emotion and didn't bother her whether it was a man talking to a woman or a woman to a man. It was one human being to another, and that was what she grasped.
The forlorn lovers' wanderings are coming to their end, and death is near. There, beyond the village, stands an organ grinder. Barefoot on the ice, he staggers to and fro, his little plate always empty. No one wants to hear him, and no one gives him a glance, and the dogs snarl all around him. Wondrous old man, shall I go with you? Will you grind your organ to my singing? Der Leiermann, the organ grinder, the final song in Schubert's cycle Winterreise, Winter Journey. Settings of poems by Wilhelm Müller. Lotte Lehmann was accompanied by Paul Ulanowski. At her song recitals, Lotte Lehmann created great tension, as much by her physical presence as by her singing. Soprano Carol Neblett recalls the extra dimension she gave Lieder when she studied Winterreise and other songs with her.
She was unique in her approach because it was an approach that was an actress always. She acted when she sang Schubert songs. I happen to have learned the entire Die Schöne Müllerin and Winterreise when I went to a study with them in a class when I was 14 years old. So this was a huge revelation to me because I saw that the words had such a depth, had such a meaning. So it was not new to me to explore the words. What the newness was how do you see the entire scene? Can you see the picture? Can you see the trees and the brook? Can you see all this? You need to see it. You can't just say it.
She had this incredible childlike imagination. She could just kind of imagine anything. And it was just wonderful to see that in action.
I'm astounded by one record of Aufträge, a song by Schumann, Nicht so schnelle, nicht so schnelle, which she made with the very distinguished pre-Gerald Moore accompanist, a man by the name of George Reeves, who was the great British accompanist before Gerald Moore. And this performance, you can only imagine how much Elizabeth Schwarzkopf must have listened to this as a young girl, had admired it and modelled herself using a combination of speech on the nicht so schnell, nicht so, so that you hardly are aware where the sound begins as speech and as sung tone. It's a sort of rather a Schwarzkopfian colour in a way, but it was invented in a sense by Lehmann.
Nicht so schnelle, nicht so schnelle, mach ein wenig kleine Welle. Will dir einen Auftrag geben, an die Liebste mein, wirst du ihr vorüber schweben, grüßt sie mir fein. Sag, ich wäre mitgekommen, auf dir selbst herabgeschwommen, für den Gruß einen Kuss. Kühn mir zu erbitten, doch der Zeitdringlichkeit ist es nicht gewesen. Nicht so eilig halt erlaube, kleine leicht beschminkte Taube, habe dir was aufzutragen an die Liebste mein, sollst dir tausend Grüße fragen, hundert obendrein. Sag, ich wär mit dir geflogen, über Berg und Strom gezogen, für den Gruß, einen Kuss, kühn dir zu erbitten, doch der Zeitdringlichkeit ist es nicht gewesen. Warte nicht, dass ich dich treibe, wo du träge Mondes Scheibe, weißt ja, was ich dir befohlen.
Aufträge, messages, by Schumann. A young man attempts to send messages of love to his sweetheart through a wave, a dove, and the moon. And speaking just after Carol Neblett beforehand were Marilyn Horne and Graham Johnson. As well as attending her masterclasses, Carol Neblett received individual lessons from Lotte Lehmann. Very individual ones from the very start.
I was greeted at the door by her lovely assistant, Frances Holden, and then I was taken in, and she was in a wheelchair at the time, Madame Lehmann, because she was having problems with her legs and things. And I did a little, we did a little of the niceties of how do you do and so on and so forth. And then I began to sing, and I believe at the time I was singing a Richard Strauss, and I had an aria prepared. I had prepared the Faust aria, you know, the Jewel song, from the beginning scene, from the very beginning opening recitative. So I began to sing, and suddenly she stopped me, and I thought I was going to hear a vocal, you know, criticism or help or suggestion. Instead, she said, "Let me see your legs." So I looked a little puzzled, and, you know, I really want to see your legs. So I pulled my dress up a little, and she says, "No, no, all the way up. Pull your dress all the way up." So I pulled my dress all the way up to the very top of the legs, and she said, "Oh, good. You have the good legs. You can sing all the sexy roles." She was so sweet, because then she said, "You know, I could not do those roles. My legs were just not the kind of legs to do those roles." And that was my first encounter. And of course, she went on with vocal ideas and phrasing and all kinds of things like that. And quite amazing, I must say.
But that was just the beginning. Over a period of several years, Lotte Lehmann gave Carol Neblett her devoted attention that went beyond just singing, as she did with all her pupils who were devoted to their studies. Grace Bunbury was one of them.
She did not give me voice lessons. She gave me lessons in interpretation and how to analyze a piece of music. I don't even think that she realized that she was giving a lesson in analysis of music, but for me, she did, because it made me aware of the fact that there's more to a piece of music than what's obvious, which is, of course, the words and the notes, but what is beneath those notes, what is in those harmonies, and what the flavor was that the composer was looking for, and that you can only hear by listening to the music, the printed word of the piano or the orchestra. You find the colors of your voice from what is there on the page beneath the words, behind the words.
And everything had to come from within the individual feeling, experience, and discovery of each singer. Lotte Lehmann felt her mission was to help her pupils to be aware what to look for and what to think about. And that was subtly not the same as telling them exactly what their interpretation should be.
I had some recordings of her, and I played them, and the next time I came back, I was making a complete imitation. I will use Zueignung as a great one, too. Zueignung of Strauss. And I was taking breaths all over the place. "Ja, du weißt es, teure Seele," you know, like that. And she stopped me. She said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm doing exactly what you did on your recording." She said, "Oh, no, this is not good, bad, good, no." I said, "Well, what's the matter?" And she said, "I had no breath control. My breathing was terrible. You have long line singing, use long line." But she was adamant that I should not copy her. Absolutely adamant. And then in the humility of saying, "I did not have the good breath. I did not breathe with the greatest ease."
If everybody would sing the same way, let's say a concert program, some singer would sing it very beautifully. And now everybody takes this one singer as a model, and does it in the same way. Wouldn't that be boring? I mean, then one has heard it once, and one says, "I don't go ever in my life again to a concert. I have heard everything." No, it should be different. It should fit to the personality, and that is what I always strive to do in my teaching, and not that I want them to imitate me. Imitation is always a sign of an artistic weakness. I only want to arouse their imagination and to develop their personalities.
It's an individuality that she did like to see. Did you have the, shall I just go so far as saying, do you have the guts to do something that's different? If you do something that's different, you must do it so convincingly no one will criticize it. Or they may, They may criticize it, but did you know in your heart you did it the right way?
Provided the individuality came from within the genuine emotional experience of the performer.
Every artificiality is something which I dislike very much. There are young singers who do what I say from the outside, you know. And in a short time, one cannot alter that. I can only try to. But they have to believe it. They have to feel it, really. Only then it will go over to the public. And the audience is really very, very sensitive. I think they feel that very soon. They may be fooled by somebody for a time. But I think in a longer run, only the real sincere artist will hold their love.
Lotte Lehmann in conversation with Studs Terkel on WFMT in 1960, and before her, Carol Neblett. Those musicians who received Lotte Lehmann's teaching and masterclasses experienced a dimension of live creativity that far surpassed their expectations.
One afternoon, I said, I so would have loved to have seen your Marschallin. And she said, well, I will do it now. For you. And she was in her wheelchair and she started the scene where she, you know, speaks of her youth going and losing, needing to give up Octavian and so on and so forth. And I want to tell you something. Before my eyes, she was singing it an octave down. She was actually singing the notes, but in an octave further down than written. She actually changed from a woman who was getting quite old and in a wheelchair, she became the Marschallin right before my eyes. The most beautiful woman with these eyes and this expression. It was unbelievable, it really was.
When she demonstrated a song or a scene, she communicated every shade of feeling through facial expression, body language, verbal inflection, articulation, phrasing, rhythmic subtlety, a painter's palette of colors. Her personality, of course, was unique and inimitable, but each singer could adapt those techniques of expression to his or her own individual nature.
Her face was so special. Her face was amazing when she was singing. The idea that one could change before you, a complete look by what she was thinking. What she was thinking. As opposed to what she was doing. She wasn't running around. Of course, the Marschallin doesn't run around in that scene anyway. But the inner working, the inner ability to be that person was really extraordinary.
And before Carol Neblett was the voice of Beaumont Glass. He served as Lotte Lehmann's assistant at the Music Academy of the West for many years, and he also accompanied her on numerous occasions. His book, Lotte Lehmann, A Life in Opera and Song, is the authorised biography of her life. It reveals how she decided of her own volition to leave Austria in 1938 in protest against the Nazis when they annexed the country in the Anschluss. She didn't have to leave, as she wasn't Jewish. And after having first given up her homeland, Germany, now to leave Vienna, which had become almost her second home, was a deeply traumatic experience. But Lotte Lehmann profoundly opposed the Nazi regime, and despite the seriously deteriorating health of her husband, who tragically was to die just a year later, she'd made up her mind. Soon after arriving in America, it was a particularly ironic and emotional experience to sing Kennst du das Land by Hugo Wolf, where the poet asks to be taken to a distant land, the land of her birth.
Of blue and green.
there is a nostalgia, a sense of drama, a sense of love and regret and pain that encapsulates the whole history of the 20th century for a young German girl, creative, growing up to her prime between the wars, and who made the decision to leave the Nazi orbit, not because she had to, but because she couldn't bear what it had become, and because it represented for her a complete ruination, spoiling, degradation of the Germany she knew and loved.
Graham Johnson. And so it was that Lottie Lehmann settled in the United States and began the last phase of her performing career. There was more opera for a time, but the years were passing by, and after 1946, she decided to concentrate on Lieder, and before long, teaching. The Music Academy of the West was set up, her masterclasses began in 1951, and that same year, she gave what she decided would be her farewell recital at Town Hall in New York. The audience wasn't yet aware of that, and so it came as a bolt out of the blue when Lottie Lehmann told them after singing Andy Musik by Schubert. It had already been a very moving evening. At the very end of the song, the emotion was too great for her, and the final notes were hardly there. It's one of the most moving documents of an artist ever recorded.
Announce it before, because I don't like to celebrate my own funeral. But this tonight is my farewell recital in New York. Thank you. I hoped you would protest. But please don't argue with me. You see, I started to sing in public at 1910. And after 41 years of hard work, inattention, and nervous strain, I think I deserve to take it easy and to relax.
When I was a young singer, I had already decided when the time comes that I think I should stop, I will. And I have always tried to be very objective with myself. And the time when it was 1951, when I ceased to sing concerts, all my friends were horrified. Everybody said to me, but that's ridiculous, you could certainly sing some more years. It would have been perhaps possible, but I didn't want to. I couldn't do any more what I was accustomed to do. I was always an artist who gave everything, gave out of the fullness of my emotion. And I couldn't do that anymore, because when I made up a program, I had to be careful. I had to leave out songs, for instance, which were too strenuous for me, too dramatic, which were not anymore in my reach. And that I couldn't stand. And through the last year of my concert career, I suffered terribly. and I was not fooled by the applause, by the loyalty of my audience. Very often when I came home after a concert which had been tremendously successful, I was weeping the whole night because I had the feeling I really have betrayed my audience because I didn't give any more what I was able to give some years ago.
Lottie Lehmann, speaking with Studs Terkel in 1960. Although she'd retired from singing 9 years earlier, her influence was to continue to be intently felt for a long time yet in her lifetime, through her teaching, her masterclasses, and her recordings. And then, after her death in 1976, her influence continued to flourish for future generations in a specially focused way when, in 1997, the Lotte Lehmann Foundation was created by Gary Hickling, who was its president for 6 years and is still vitally involved with its operations.
What's important for us to remember is to try to inspire young artists by example, by Lehmann's example, by others' examples. But ours is the Lotte Lehmann Foundation, and so we do have the dual mission of bringing Lehmann to anybody who wants to hear it easily right there on the website. And then with the various projects that we have to encourage singers, especially in the art song, in Lieder, Melody, because Lehmann said herself to me, and I have it in one of my interviews, where she said that opera will always make its way. It's the lead singer, she said, that really needs our support. And so that's where we have placed our emphasis for the Lehmann Foundation.
And so the Lotte Lehmann Foundation has initiated two ambitious and flourishingly successful projects for art song, not only for its performance, but also for its composition. Darren Hagen, today's president of the foundation, and himself an admired composer, explains.
The Lehmann Foundation exists for more than the perpetuation of Lehmann's legacy. It exists also to extend and expand her vision and that thing that she lived. And in doing so, we've got two primary programs. One is an international song, singing, and performing competition, which is internet-based with entrants. It's quite amazing. Entrants from Borneo to Bogota, Buffalo to, my goodness, I'm running out of bees, but all over the world, and it's amazing, non-professional singers, singers of every age, and quite excellent professional singers. It's a huge undertaking, but it's about the process of getting people to sing and the process of getting them to learn art songs, which we believe Madame Lehmann would have loved. The other primary program we have is an art song composition contest that we have started with the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, ASCAP, here in the United States, and that is to encourage the creation of art songs. So between performance and creation, that covers those programs. And then we also have launched a publishing arm to bring to light hitherto unpublished art songs by composers who haven't previously been able to access publishing. Also, Damien Topp, one of our advisors in France, has been feeding us unpublished songs by major French composers that we're bringing into print as a service to the repertoire.
This song by Poulenc, Violon, is simply a tribute to the violin, although with some oblique allusions between its strings and the rope of a hangman. Singing it here is the winner of Cybersing in 2004, mezzo-soprano Valerie Comar.
Thank you. I had the pleasure of competing in that competition and winning the grand prize. And besides the generous award, was a chance to be further linked with some great artists, most recently getting to sing and honor the lovely and amazing Phyllis Curtin and Ned Roram, as well as their director, Darren Hagen, a wonderful songwriter in person. And so it's helped me immensely with continuing to know people in the song world, which is amazingly small.
Valerie Comar. Her career's taking off very excitingly right now, both in song and in opera. Although she never knew Lotte Lehmann, experiencing her through the foundation has made its mark through her approach and outlook.
It takes a great amount of growth and confidence, and that's something Lotte Lehmann, I think, really possesses, especially when I hear her in those old master classes and such. You know, she's not claiming perfection, but she is claiming individualism.
And so, thanks to the Lotte Lehmann Foundation, that vital confidence that she was able to instill into young musicians in her lifetime through her completely individual approach to opening out the mind and the imagination can have its effect today, 30 years after her death. And it's not only musicians who've been deeply affected by her. The film documentary maker Christopher Newpen's entire life was changed by a chance meeting with her in 1955 when he found himself sitting next to her in a box at a performance at the Vienna State Opera. Actually, the box was empty when he was in there at first.
I'm sitting in the box, nobody comes, it's about to start, I move to the front row. At this moment, the door opens, and in walks a woman with silver hair combed back and a silver fur coat down to the floor. And she looked magnificent. And I took a look at this, and I thought, it's Lotte Lehmann. And so I said, you are Lotte Lehmann. And she said, yes, I'm Lotte Lehmann, and when you've recovered from your surprise, can I please go to my seat? That's what she was like. This was, in a certain way, the most honest person that I've ever met in my life. Nathan Milstein, rather similar. So honest and so pure in their thinking. Now, pure is a dangerous word. Lotte was not what most people would regard as pure, but what I regard as pure, because her thinking was uncluttered by pretense, uncluttered by what people would expect of you and things like that. She said what she felt, and what she felt very deeply, because she had a high intelligence, she had a high character, and she was a very successful human being, and that helps you. And so she said to me, when you've got over your surprise, can I please go to my seat? So, of course, I moved, and then the whole public stood up and started shouting, Hoch Lehmann. So there was this 20-year-old in his white tie and tails skipping about like a rabbit between her public and this great artist. Anyway, I then went back to my back seat, the seat number 6, and nobody else came. And I was in the wrong box, but I was in Lotte Lehmann's box. So I moved into the seat immediately behind her, and she kept, during the performance, she kept saying, schöne Stimme, schöne Stimme. Beautiful voice, speaking of Leonie Riesenegg. Comes the interval, and I felt I'd better do something. So I said, Madame Lehmann, I came to Vienna looking for a princess, and I've found something better. I have found myself in a box with one of the greatest operatic artists this world has ever seen. And that has justified my trip to Vienna. She said, where are you staying? I said, I'm in the Hotel Regina. She said, well, I hope you have a good trip to Vienna, a good stay in Vienna. The following day comes a photograph, signed, to C.P. Newpen, my charming neighbour in box 11, Lotte Lehmann, and an invitation to lunch. I had dinner with her about 8 times in 2 weeks. And we laughed and we joked. And one day she said to me, "What do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm working in a merchant bank." I'd studied law and I was working in a merchant bank. And she said, "You are working in a bank? That is completely impossible." I changed my job because of Lotte Lehmann. But much more than that, much more than that, I do what I do today because of Lotte Lehmann. What is it that she gave me? The knowledge that I was not going to be a performer, the realization that I understood something about it, and that if Lotte Lehmann felt I understood something about it and was prepared to talk about performance to me, then it meant, A, that I had got some understanding, and B, that I could devote my life to using public service broadcasting to tell the world how wonderful is music and how talented are my friends. And so the confidence she gave me prepared me for friendships, very close friendships, that followed later. And so what is it that enabled me to be close to and trusted by these people that I so much imagined? The answer is Lotte Lehmann. There's no question whatsoever about it. And so that's my career, making radio and making television with great artists, because Lotte Lehmann gave me the confidence to do that.
When I got my first job as a Rockefeller Fellow teaching double bass and playing principal bass in the Manila Symphony in the Philippines, waiting for me was a letter from Madame Lehmann congratulating me on my first job. The director of music there was Herbert Zipper, a very famous, in his time, Viennese conductor, who, of course, grew up hearing Lehmann sing in Vienna. And he was the one who received the letter and handed it to me. And across the back was scrawled Madame Lehmann's famous signature. And he said, "Do you know Lotte Lehmann?" in this reverential tone. And I said, "Oh, yeah, she's a friend of mine." And he said, "Oh, give her my highest regards and tell her that this fan will never forget what she did." And so I did write her back, and we stayed in correspondence for years. She answered every letter from this double bassist.
Gary Hickling, and before him, Christopher Newpen. Lotte Lehmann cared passionately about music, about life, about people. 30 years after her death, that life-giving love, commitment, and fearless outspokenness is living on through the recordings of her classes and performances, her writings, including her autobiography, and also the creative operations of the Lotte Lehmann Foundation, which has generously underwritten this tribute to her here on the WFMT radio network. I'm John Talansky. I've been your host and producer of Lotte Lehmann, Her Life and Living Legacy, our glimpse of only a part of the extraordinary life and career of a unique figure in the history of music, Lotte Lehmann.
Just this total immersion, this total believability. Never, ever is there a sacrifice or a necessity to sacrifice that beautiful, grounded, human song and singing, the Gesangkultur. This is what I adore.
Lotte Lehmann will always remain for me the most important person in my entire musical life.
Könnt ich glauben,